Hi, this is Paul, and this is the video some of you have been waiting for. We're going to talk about UFOs, religion, technology, consciousness, all of that. I got started on this book because of Cale Zeldin. Cale Zeldin messaged me, gave me two book recommendations, gave me the Profelicity book by Hans-Georg Müller, which is good, and that sort of cleared up a whole bunch of things for me. And he also sent me this book, which I didn't really understand that well. But ever since I was a kid, remember that Leonard Nimoy program that I grew up with? It had aliens, it had Bigfoot, it had all of these things sort of on the fringe of secularity. In Search Of, was that the name of it? I'll have to look it up. Yes, indeed, it was Leonard Nimoy. I remembered correctly, which is a nice thing to do after all these years. But I was always fascinated by that program, fascinated by things at the fringe. Jacob said, you know, one of the things that he really loved about me going to the ARC conference was that I finally had to recognize that I was sitting at the big boys table. Well, you know what, Jacob? I realized what I always realized, that I'm always uncomfortable at the big boys table. I like the fringe. I like the fringe. And if you don't believe that, that's why I'm such a big fan of Grim Grizz and you, Jacob, because you're a pretty fringy guy too. Anyway, this book, American Cosmic, Cale Zeldin recommends to me, and Cale bats 1,000 when it comes to book recommendations. When he recommends books to me, they're usually good. Cale knows his stuff. It's also the case that Cale has been feeding a bunch of us, so Cale regularly also feeds Rod Dreher. Rod Dreher is working on a book about enchantment, and not all of you are really happy with that word, and he's looking for a publisher to publish it, and he's been writing about that on his Substack. Rod Dreher's Substack is one of the few Substacks that I just look at. Now, I'm a fringe person. The people's Substacks that I do support the free press, but I also have Paul Kingsnorth and his Substack and Rod Dreher. What is it? Me sending my money to all these orthodox people? I don't know. Where's that going? Anyway. American Cosmic. And it begins with talking about Jacques Vallée. And then chapter one talks about Tyler D., who, of course, these are all people that are involved in the whole UFO, this whole thing. And I had really, my impression of the whole UFO thing for the most part has been, again, fringe people. Now, I'm a fringe person too, so I'm not skeptical, or I'm not a denier. I'm not saying these people are lying, but I'm sure there are liars out there, and I'm sure there are con men out there and con women out there, and I'm sure that there's plenty of misunderstanding and foolishness going on, but I'm not the kind of skeptic that when he sits in front of a person who, for the most part, is reliable, you can read that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and they say something outlandish, I just listen, because what do I know? Maybe they're right. Maybe they saw something. I'm sure they saw something, but is their interpretation of what they saw the correct thing? What D.A. Pasulka does, so I did a little bit of investigating on her too. Diane Walsh Pasulka is an American writer, professor of religious studies at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, B.A. at UC Davis, good for her. Her first book was about purgatory, and now that I've read or almost finished reading, which is, it says something about a book if I actually finish reading the whole darn thing, because usually I read it and then I find places to sort of hop, skip, and a junk because I'm ADHD. I just posted that on Twitter today because someone once again left a message on one of my videos. Because on the Jordan Peterson Believe in God video, of course, goes beyond the realms of this little corner. That's sort of when the whoosh from the stream during a flood breaks out over the estuary onto the open sea. And then someone says, that's not this video. That's another kind of comment that, well, where can I find the video where we don't have this guy just interrupting all the time? Here's the comment, ADD, this video lacks focus to a degree that it actually made me violently angry. Oh my, someone, I don't know if he threw something or broke something or kicked the dog or yelled at the wife, or maybe they don't have that much impulse control and they just, you know, threw something at the computer. I don't know. then someone lovingly sent me this, which I proceeded to show to my wife, and she laughed. The point I'm trying to make, and for those of you listening on the audio, don't want to ignore the audio portion, the audio-only portion. You have these nice straight highways with this car and this truck going straight down the highway. That's the point I'm trying to make. The way I explain it looks like this abundant multiplex clover leaf overpass. So I started out making a video about UFOs. I went to DA Pasulka, and here I am talking about memes on the internet. Let's proceed. So she wrote a book about purgatory, which I'm now very interested in. She was studying appearances of Virgin Mary, which I was very interested in, because, again, I've always been sort of a fringy creature, and it just has never seemed reasonable to me to simply dismiss all kinds of fairly common human experience to just people being crazy or unsettled or machinations or who knows what. Has never made sense to me, which is why I believe in miracles, I believe in all sorts of things, because, you know, what do I know? In fact, my dominant posture is don't disbelieve it necessarily. Again, goes back to C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The result was the next morning they decided they really would go and tell the whole thing to the professor. He'll write to father if he thinks there's something really wrong with Lou, meaning Lucy, said Peter. It's getting beyond us. So they went and knocked at the study door, and the professor said, come in, and got up and found a chair for them, and he said he was quite at their disposal. I looked up, and I at least saw from the outside Lewis's house, the Kilns, in just outside of Oxford, which was a highlight of my trip. And I'm surely grateful to my gracious host for bringing me out there. She lives in Oxford, and she had never been there, so it was a delight. But I wasn't there on a day of the week that they actually had tours, so I'll have to go back at some point and see the inside. Come in, and they found a chair. Then he sat down and listened to them with the tips of his fingers pressed together, never interrupting, till they had finished the whole story. After that, he said nothing for quite a while. He cleared his throat and said the last thing either of them expected. How do you know, he asked, that your sister's story is not true? Oh, but, began Susan, and then stopped. Anyone could see from the old man's face that he was perfectly serious. Then Susan pulled herself together and said, Edmund said they had only been pretending. Well, that is a point, said the professor, which certainly deserves consideration, very careful consideration. For instance, if you excuse me for asking the question, does your experience lead you to regard your brother or your sister as the more reliable? I mean, which is the more truthful? Well, that's a funny thing about it, said Peter. Up until now, I'd say losing every time. Poor Edmund. And what do you think, my dear? Said the professor, turning to Susan. Well, said Susan, in general, I'd say the same as Peter. But this couldn't be true. It's all about the wood and the fawn. Well, that is more than I know, said the professor. This is something that I learned from my father. My father would say this all the time. And this was one of the... It's going to make me cry thinking about my father. It's so funny because my father was not someone who at least seemingly was all about intentionally discipling me. But he did in so many ways. And this was one of the ways. He would sit down and he'd tell us stories about what was going on, you know, not confidential stories about what was going on around us or in the ministry or stories he'd hear. And he'd also always remind us that, you know, don't go beyond what you know. In other words, you can listen to this and you can think about it and you can form opinions and you can do all of that, but you don't know. So, well, that is more than I know, said the professor. And the charge of lying against someone who you've always found truthful is a very serious thing, a very serious thing indeed. We're afraid it mightn't even be lying, said Susan. We thought that there might be something wrong with Lucy. Madness, you mean? Said the professor quite coolly. Oh, you can make your minds easily about that. One is only to look at her and talk to her and see that she is not mad. Now, one of the most fun things about the Europe trip was in our estuary meeting in the pub in London. Someone who's been on the channel, I won't out her, came, and she told us stories about, just like she did when she was had her Randos conversation, about her dreams and her visions, and I just really enjoy her. I didn't recognize her at first, but then they started talking, and her name, just, it's not a name that's common in the U.S., and so bang, and so I was so glad she came. She had some new visions that she shared, and she and her husband were there, and they were just absolutely a delight. And she's not mad. But then said Susie and stopped. She had never dreamed that a grown-up would talk like the professor and didn't know what to think. Ah, logic, said the professor half to himself. Why don't they teach logic at these schools? There are only three possibilities. Either your sister is telling lies, or she is mad, or she's telling the truth. Now, of course, you can't push this too far. Alistair McGrath, in his biography of Lewis, has a nice treatment, sort of walking around Lewis's famous argument about Jesus, the three-pronged argument, said, you know, you can't push that too far. And there are definitely weaknesses to it, because Lucy could be generally, you know, there could be hallucinations. There are more options on the list. You know, she doesn't tell lies, and it's obvious she's not mad. For the moment, then, unless any further evidence turns up, you must assume she is telling the truth. Susan looked at him very hard and was quite sure from the expression on his face that he was not making fun of them. But how can it be true, sir? Said the professor. Why do you say that? Asked the professor. Well, for one thing, Peter, if it was real, why doesn't everyone find this country every time they go back to the wardrobe? Oh, the scientific method. I mean, is there anything there when we looked? Even Susie didn't pretend there was. What does that have to do with it? Said the professor. Well, sir, if things are real, then they're all the time. Really, are they? Are they? Said the professor. And Peter did not quite know what to say. Because of the scientific lab leak, that's how we think reality works. And it works that way a lot. But it doesn't obviously work that way with everything. Because we're sort of living within this narrow box in the modernistic materialist secular world that says there are no conscious creatures higher than us, and there's no bigger actors higher than us, even though we're sort of submerged in all of these spirits that are mucking around, changing our politics, you know, putting history into ways that we don't imagine they could. But there was no time, said Susan. Lucy had no time to go anywhere. Even if there was such a place, she came running after us a few moments when we were out of the room. It was less than a minute, and she pretended to have been there for hours. Well, that's the very thing that makes her story so quite likely to be true, said the professor. If there really is a door in this house that leads to some other world, and I should warn you that this is a very strange house, and even I know very little about it, if I say they had gotten into another world, I should not be at all surprised to find that the other world had separate time of its own, so that however long you stayed there, it would never take up any of our time. On the other hand, I don't think many girls of her age would invent that idea for themselves. If she had been pretending, she would have hidden for a reasonable amount of time before coming out and telling her story. But do you really mean, sir, said Peter, that there could be other worlds all over the place, just around the corner, just like that? some of these old drawings from the middle of the 20th century are really quite precious. They're innocent. Nothing is more probable, said the professor, taking off his spectacles and beginning to polish them, while he muttered to himself, I wonder what they do teach them at schools. But what are we to do, said Susan. She felt that the conversation was beginning to get off the point. Well, or maybe even a little out of hand. My dear young lady, said the professor, suddenly looking up with a very sharp expression at both of them, there is one plan which no one has yet suggested, which is well worth trying. What is that, said Susan? We might all try minding our own business. This one on YouTube, for those of you who couldn't find the clips of what I was talking about with respect to Jordan Peterson, because they're on HBO, and HBO is not about to just sort of let the whole thing out. Bill Maher had a nice little editorial on No Opinion, which was really quite good. There's a whole bunch of things you don't really need to have an opinion on, or if you have an opinion, you can hold it rather loosely, and you certainly can't put the whole world together. Just you don't have to make epistemic commitments beyond what you really have to make. Now, in sort of the regular world, they're sort of walking around and doing things, and you make those epistemic commitments as they go. But that, in fact, is what a lot of people don't understand what Christians mean by faith. "We might all try minding our own business," said he, and that was the end of the conversation, which was actually a delight because, of course, the children would go looking into the wardrobe again, and this time they would be out in a wood because, well, why? Because someone was, in fact, managing the wardrobe and the back of it in a way that the children could not understand because they are, of course, children. But, of course, the professor knew enough to not presume to understand it, but just that strange things can happen. And, of course, Lewis not only wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but he wrote a prequel, The Magician's Nephew, which set off the eternal debate, and some of you can wade in the comments section if you want, how to number The Chronicles of Narnia, and if you should start reading at The Magician's Nephew, or if you should start reading at The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So let's get into the second chapter of this book about James. And the way she goes about this, I think, is really rather wise, because this is a sensitive topic because, again, because of the scientific lab leak, you lose status if you admit to believing in such things, at least in certain communities. Refer back to Dallas Willard's video on worldviews that I can't play because, well, I can play it, but I don't know why the Veritas Forum keeps such tight reins on their material. Anyway, so she's talking about James. James was the first scientist I met who was out as an experiencer. He was also a rare category as an academic who studied the phenomenon. My colleague and I heard that he might be interested in attending a small get-together of like-minded colleagues. We did so we did background research on him. What we found blew our mind. He held an endowed chair of molecular biology and headed a laboratory at one of the top universities in the world. He was a successful inventor. He had a global reputation for pushing the boundaries of science and biotechnology. In our correspondence with him, we were astonished by his openness. He was very transparent about his interest in the phenomenon, and he seemed, at least in email, devoid of pretension. He was a top dog, but acted like a regular guy. I liked him already. Me too. Now, she, sort of like John Vervaeke, adopts a vocabulary and constructs the vocabulary, which I think is tremendously helpful because a lot of the other vocabulary around this area is sort of it's clouded with pejorative status-losing jabs. I'll say it that way. At dinner that evening, I made sure to sit next to James. I offered him some wine, and he related his experiences with the phenomena, which began in his childhood. When he was 5 or 6 years old, he recalled little people would appear in his room. They stood by his bed and looked at him through his bedroom windows. He insisted that he was awake when these experiences took place, and he said emphatically, "I was not asleep. Oh, and I was paralyzed." He explained this to his parents, who told him that he had had some bad dreams. Now, again, it's a perfectly reasonable thing for the parents to say, of course, because in many cases, it's bad dreams. I'll tell you a story. When my wife and I were in the Dominican Republic, there was a... we were staying at the Mission Guest House, and I don't remember what woke her up in the middle of the night, but there's so many stories. But she saw over me a giant figure. Now, was she asleep? I don't know. Was she awake? I don't know. I was asleep. She says I was asleep, but she saw this giant figure who was sort of moving in a way. All she could see was sort of up to the middle of his belly. The rest was up above the ceiling. And now my wife, these things don't happen to her. I mean, she doesn't, we've been married for 35 years. We've known each other for 37 years. She doesn't have very many stories like this. She's got other stories of having senses about things, but she doesn't, I mean, no more than a handful. But she had this experience, and she told me about it. There was another situation once where, and again, all of these, I mean, you could, the Amazing Randy won't give me $1 million for these things. I'll tell you that right now. But there was another situation where my sister was in a prayer group at a church in Grand Rapids where we both had ministered. And there was another woman in the prayer group, and this woman had some spiritual gifts. And we had both gone to that church. And then my sister was in this group, and then this woman says, Paul Vanderclay, we have to pray for Paul Vanderclay. And she said, I don't know who Paul Vanderclay is. And my sister said, well, I know who he is. And she told me about it. Now, why, when, I don't have anything to correlate that to, but it just happened. And my sister would have no reason to make up that story. It just happened. And of course, you can explain it. I'd been in that church. You might have heard my name. It could pop into her head. Yada, 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 so on and so forth. These things happen. So here he's telling the story of him as a child. Yet he told me he knew that these night visitors were real. Later, as a teenager, he had a strange encounter while delivering newspapers on a paper route. One of his customers, Mr. Jameson, demanded that his paper be delivered at 5:30 a.m. every morning. If James didn't make it in time, he might lose his route. One morning, as he frantically pushed towards Mr. Jameson's house, he realized he wasn't going to make it on time. He sometimes took a shortcut through the woods, though he had felt apprehensive about the area. But he was also late, so he had to use a shortcut. When he entered the forest, things didn't feel normal. A shapeless formation of light slowly paused over him, just above the treetops. It was about 20 feet across and completely soundless. He felt frozen in a time warp of light, bright as the sun, with no apparent source except itself. James just stood and watched in awe. It came and went in less than 10 seconds. James kept his paper route, but from this point onward, he completely avoided those woods. Nothing happened again until he was in his 30s. One night he woke from a sound sleep and saw a thin, tall, thin presence at the end of his bed. It was smoky and translucent. He did not feel afraid, even though he was, again, paralyzed. In his head he heard the words, "Go to sleep," and he did. I mean, this is terrifying, of course. This is the stuff that horror movies are made of, but here it is. When he arrived at our small hotel, the room James had given had a window that wouldn't close all the way, and there were no shades. He made it clear to the proprietor that this was unacceptable. Later, I realized that James had developed a fear of open windows in childhood and was now a compulsion. He needed to close the windows and cover them up with curtains. A close relative, he said, suffered from the same fear. Once as a teenager, James pranked his relative by drawing a picture of a scary face and posting it on her window. The prank went very wrong. Upon seeing the face, the girl turned white and asked James, "How did you know?" And for years afterwards, he wondered about her reaction. After the incident, with the presence in his bedroom, a chance occurrence opened James to the possibility that his experiences were related to the UFO phenomena. And see, when I read this, I thought, I've heard plenty of stories, and in fact have one story myself of a strange nighttime experience. I mean, could it be that my wife didn't wake up? She swore she did. My wife is a truthful person, and I believe her when she tells me things, because again, I've known her for 37 years. What did she see? I have no idea. But to connect that with UFOs, that connection I had never sort of made. An avid reader of science fiction, James picked up a book by Harvard researcher John Mack, Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. James at first thought the book was fiction. He was shocked by what he read. The experience of Mack's subjects were exactly like his own. They described night visitors who paralyzed them and seemed to watch them in their sleep. The beings also spoke on the subjects to the subjects telepathically. Mack had gained notoriety for this claim that the experiencers were psychologically healthy and that the experiences they described were common. He saw this as a significant cultural development that demanded serious scholarly attention. By the end of the book, James realized he was reading what amounted to the story of his life. So I mentioned in another video that my son and I often get together to watch The Curse of Oak Island. I've been fascinated by their treasure hunt for the last 10 years, and although I regularly sit in my living room with skeptic and scoffers that say that there's nothing left there and it was only a way station, etc., etc., Jared and I, we believe. And so maybe this year they'll find it. If it weren't for those darn Canadian codes that keep stopping them, we need a permit. It's your own land. We need a permit. And of course, please don't find any Indian pottery. Anyway, after Curse of Oak Island, as the History Channel likes to do, then they put on other shows to get you hooked, because I'm sure Curse of Oak Island is one of their biggest shows. And so then they had Skinwalker Ranch, and it was like, oh, so Jared and I would have fun with that. We made some aluminum foil hats, and, so Jared and I always just sort of make it a party when we watch these shows together. What's interesting, of course, about Skinwalker Ranch is that there is a history to it that goes back into Native Americans and goes back into curses and goes back into questions of evil spirits, demons, and the like. And it's been fascinating watching this program because there's all of this strange phenomena. And of course, the people who are studying it are, some of them are scientists, astrophysicists, and they're using all this instrumentation, and they try to provoke these lights and yada, yada, yada. And sometimes things work and sometimes things don't. But of course, just like with the wardrobe's closet, if you're dealing with beings that are at least as smart as us, and even as smart as my dog, because my dog even knows to do things or not to do things when I'm looking. If we're dealing with those kinds of things, well, they're going to react to us and respond to us and going to react to us and respond to us in ways that basically are within their own interests. That's just reasonable. Again, what we deal with in our culture is the scientistic lab leak, where we assume that there are no conscious agents above or beyond human beings. Now, some people sort of with kind of a... So then you have the whole part of the conversation that is built within the scientistic lab leak that says, well, maybe because of evolution, yada, 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 people on other planets, yada, yada, yada. And then you have these other boundary markers that, well, civilizations tend to destroy themselves. Some of you know way more about this than I do, but I've watched these videos, I've heard these stories, it's a very interesting conversation. Then, of course, you have Elon Musk's idea that, about the simulation. And what this shows is that this scientistic materialism that we live in sort of frays at the edges. And these assumptions that we're walking around probably aren't the best assumptions to be walking around with if, in fact, we're dealing with a universe that is far larger and stranger than we are and has intelligences and agents, not just three-letter agencies, but other agencies that are far above and beyond us. That's, to me, just reasonable. I'm not quite done with the book. I have chapter 7 to go, and I'm sure Kale is going to jump and say, oh, you haven't read chapter 7 yet. You got to read chapter 7. I will, Kale. I will. I'm committed to this book, and I am going to read the successor. Rod Dreher is already in the successor, and Kale is in the successor, so we're all sort of following through this thing together, and I continue to read Rod's blog. Chapter 6 has the story of the Hernandezes. The chapter explores the experience of Ray Hernandez and his wife, Dulce, documents the unexpected twists and turns it took once he publicized it. The Hernandezes' experiences are instructive for several reasons. First, each saw something extraordinary, yet they interpreted it differently. Dulce is a devoted Catholic and interpreted her experiences as divine and within the framework of Catholic theology. Ray, who was an atheist prior to his experience, is still interpreting it. In his work, Ray delves into the testimonies of UFO contact. In its secular form, testimony is a form of evidence. To give testimony in a court of law is to provide information that is supposed to be true and correspond to real-life matters. If one provides false testimony, it's called perjury. Within the history of religions, testimony is also a type of evidence. Many religious traditions are built on the testimonies of believers. Believers report extraordinary things and events such as miracles or sightings of supernatural beings. This testimony is often accompanied by information about credentials of those who testify. In both religious cultures and UFO cultures, the credible witness is an important feature that helps us lend credibility, if not to the actual reality of extraordinary claims, at least to the fact that credible people experience extraordinary events. Many of the scientist believers I interpreted think that the phenomena functions like a technology, and that the human is a receiver, a transmitter of information. Ray and his cadre of colleagues, 12 retired physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists, and scientists, employ various methods, including quantum physics, to explain the relationship between consciousness and contact with non-human intelligence. For them, this interaction defies a dualist construction of spirit and matter and bridges the rift between two camps of researchers in UFOlogy. Ufology is what it's called, but that word, especially if you're listening to the audiobook, sort of trips you up. And this gets back to the point I was making earlier, and I've made oftentimes. If you go back to C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, the first story he tells is a story of he knows, the only person he knew who actually said that she witnessed a ghost was a woman who didn't believe in ghosts. All of our stories are interpreted through our worldview, and worldviews act as filters with respect to stories. Now, filters have two sides. Some things pass through, some things bounce off and stay on this side. And that's what happens with the woman who has the ghost story. Kind of hits her filter, bounce off here. C.S. Lewis could ask her about it. She'd tell him the story, but then she said, but I don't believe in ghosts. Well, what do you make of that? Well, it's just one of those things. And I've got a similar story with respect to Jordan Peterson. You can find in an early podcast, I should probably be making my own records of some of these things because some early podcasts with Jordan Peterson have disappeared. Grim Grizz has some of them squirreled away somewhere and sometimes replays them on his channel, which is super helpful. So lest we forget. But he has one appearance on a podcast, probably in 2017 or 2018, when he tells a story about a haunted hotel room. And I had Jordan Peterson was at this conference with a graduate student who he had named a number of times, and I started making videos about this graduate student. And he's no longer a graduate student. He's now a professor somewhere. And that professor is an atheist. And he was, you know, he had mixed feelings about everything that was going on around Jordan at the time. And so he contacted me and we spoke. We never made a recording or anything like that. We spoke a number of times and had lovely conversation. But then I asked him about this ghost story. And he confirmed it, that strange things happened in this hotel room. And, of course, Jordan sees it one way, given Jordan's worldview, especially read Jung's, this strange biography of Jung, this incident between Jung and Freud, which sort of, Jung hears the report in a piece of furniture, means a sound in the piece of furniture, then predicts the sound in the piece of furniture and freaks Freud out. Freud is not about to have any of that. But, so I asked this individual that, everything that Jordan had said about this ghost story in this hotel, this other person verified. He said, this is exactly, and in fact, added a couple new details. I said, well, what about that? He just said, strange things happen. That's the way this goes. It was very early on Sunday morning in March 2012. Ray and Dulce's beloved Nina, a Jack Russell Terrier, who had been a member of their family for 16 years, had become paralyzed the night before. Ray had contacted a veterinary friend who said that Nina had probably suffered a cerebral hemorrhage. The friend offered to open his office the following day, Sunday, to euthanize Nina. Deeply saddened, Dulce turned to her faith, prayed to God that he would send his angel to cure Nina. Now, I'm often asked about miracles, and the point I make about miracles is that it's usually not the miracles that bother people. It's usually the times that God doesn't do a miracle that really bothers people. And just hearing this story, many people will say, why on earth would God or something heal this woman's poor dog and not spare my son or daughter who was suffering terribly? And that's always a good point and a difficult point. One raised by Lou Smeads when they had the Signs and Wonders class going on at Fuller Seminary. Ray, in an interview, related That morning, her prayers were answered in a way that would shatter Ray's atheism and confirm Dulce's faith. Ray, in an interview, related the first in a series of extraordinary experiences. Figure 6.1 is the depiction of what Ray saw. Ray's wife saw something like figure 6.2. And we'll get there, I suppose. Let's see what we got. There we go. We got the pictures there. Or the illustrations, let's call them. My wife woke up and checked on the dog to see if she had regained her mobility, because, of course, she had been praying all night for her little dog that she loved. Our pet was not able to move at all, except just from the neck up. My wife then carried her down the stairs, and when she got down there, she saw an object that was floating 4 feet above the ground, 1 foot away from the wall, and it was metallic in shape, approximating something like an upside-down U. It had two ring lights in the center. My wife, being a good hardcore Catholic from Mexico, that she is, knelt down and started praying, basically saying, "If you're a bad spirit, leave. If you're a good spirit or an angel or the Virgin Mary, stay." Mexicans always see the Virgin Mary everywhere, Ray laughs. And she said, "Please stay and don't let my dog suffer, poor Nina." Nina is her name, which means little girl in Spanish. Then all of a sudden, these green lights started blinking and started flashing on her, like scanning her. At that point, she freaked out and she started, now remember, like scanning, there's an interpretation. You can't speak without interpreting, but certain things sort of are interpretive tells. She started screaming my name. It was 6 a.m, and I thought she had seen a cockroach or a little mouse on the floor. Ray laughs. So I just totally ignored her. About 10 or 15 minutes of screaming for me. Now, that's a lot of screaming for your wife. I'm sorry, Ray. If my wife screams, I come. Right away. 10 or 15 minutes of screaming for me to come downstairs, she went upstairs and literally hauled me out of bed. When I got downstairs, I saw what was not the object that she had seen. What I saw, so again, she sees something like this little globe. Dulce sees this, and Ray sees that. What I saw, I guess, to be a plasma object. This is not just an object. I call it a plasma being, a light being. Maybe he's seeing too much Ghostbusters. I don't know. Because it did control my mind. It was approximately 2 feet by 3 feet in width, 1.5 to 2 feet in length, cylindrical in shape, but it didn't have any external outer edges because it was pure energy plasma. Multicolored, translucent, and when I looked at it, I did not have any peripheral vision. Just straight ahead at that object. I could not see to my right or to my left or up or down. It was focused only on that object. But what I did was quite irrational. I stared at it. I waved my hands at it. And then I said, "Ah, BS." And I turned around. I walked upstairs. I went to my bed, folded my hands on my belly, and looked straight up at the ceiling. So for 15 minutes, I was in a hypnotic state with nothing entering my brain, my consciousness. After 15 minutes, it was as if a hypnotist had said, "Okay, kid, wake up. We're finished with your wife and your pet." And all of a sudden, I woke up and said, "Oh my God, what in the world just happened?" And I ran downstairs, and there was my wife jumping up and down saying, "Hallelujah, hallelujah, the angels cured her, the angels cured her." She was running around the living room dancing, and the dog was running up and down with the energy of a little puppy. Right there, and my whole worldview was totally shattered, Ray laughs. That was the first event. Now, there's differences between their recollections of it. And then they have another event, and then he has another event, and then he begins talking about, well, he finds this, then we learn about Edgar Mitchell, and, you know, he was an astronaut, and on and on and on, and then his work in this, and on the thing goes. So there are more stories, and you can read about them in this chapter, but Dulce begins to get concerned about Ray's behavior because he used to be this hardcore skeptic and atheist who didn't believe in any of this stuff, and now he's obsessed by it. The day after his close contact, this was with the huge UFO craft, that's another story that's in the book and you can read about it, Ray saw a YouTube video on near-death experiences that discussed the quantum physics of consciousness. He immediately stopped searching the internet and purchasing books about UFOs. Instead, he began to order books on near-death experiences and consciousness studies. Over the next 4 months, he devoured more than 200 such books, sometimes reading for 18 hours a day. He was obsessed. He neglected his job and his family and did not go outside or watch television or use the internet. Instead, until December 21, 2012, he spent all of his time reading. Dulce became concerned, as you would imagine she would. She doesn't use the internet. She's not interested in UFOs or near-death experiences or consciousness literature. She rarely discusses her experience except to say that they are her angels. She was concerned by the obsessive nature of Ray's interest. Significantly, Ray felt as if this intense book encounter was being orchestrated by the non-human intelligence that had been interacting with his family. After 4 months, he felt that he was being taken to the next level of his education. After his immersion into studies of consciousness and the literature into near-death experiences, he experienced a wonderful set of synchronicities. The synchronicities involved meeting people who had experienced near-death experiences and also hearing for the first time about his father's near-death experience. And again, in my experience as a pastor, people have experiences that they don't tell other people because they feel embarrassed by them. The dynamic in culture by the scientific lab leak means you lose status with people, so you keep your mouth shut about them, but they do tell their pastors about them. The first near-death experience story, again, you know, I was watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and all of these things. I'm sure there were some in there, but the first one I actually heard about was from a neighbor who lived two houses down who I used to babysit for. I was a teenager at that point, and she and her husband had younger children, and so I would come over, and I was just two houses down, and they trusted me, and so I would babysit for their kids, and I'd make a little extra money. She had had a significant medical emergency in which her heart stopped, and she died on the table, as it were, and they brought her back. And I do not remember much about that conversation. I do not remember the details. I remember that she didn't have a lot of details about her near-death experience. She had the tunnel of light and all of those kinds of things. But I had, of course, heard some of these things from Leonard Nimoy and In Search Of and those kinds of TV programs. But what was interesting is that here I was listening to a person who, again, was seemingly a reliable person. She paid for her babysitting, and she was a lovely neighbor, and everything was fine. But she had had a near-death experience, and it wasn't all that dramatic or complex. I'm just thinking that making this video is going to bring me a fair amount of interesting emails, but I already get interesting emails, so be it. But there it is. People have these experiences. They do. But Ray's obsession, this is Ray, R-E-Y instead of R-A-Y, Ray's obsession, well, this is bothering Dulce. After these events, Dulce told Ray that he needed to believe in God. She said that she knew that people in her church believed in God, and her belief was different from theirs. She said she could feel God and her angels. I can feel God. I feel these spirits in my hands when I pray, and I can feel the energy of God and these spirits in my body. Ray didn't accept his wife's Catholic interpretation of these strange events, but he did not reject it. At this point, Ray was utterly and totally confused. He continued to read and was confused by what he read. He experienced yet another unusual event. It came in the form of an all-out body experience that combined visual information and direct message. After the experience, Ray believed that he had been given a special project, a mission. A mission was to present to humanity the relationship between non-human intelligences that were interacting with him, the spirit world, and the physics of consciousness. In other words, he's going to found a new religion. Well, he doesn't see it that way, but that's kind of where this thing goes. Now, about at this point in the book, I was thinking about the book, and I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the prohibition in Israel of mediumship. This is, again, one of these peculiar ways in which the Hebrew scriptures, and then Christians who follow them, for the most part, have a strange rule about this that none of the other nations had. Now, some of you know that I have this other channel called Vanderclips with all of 1.12 thousand subscribers that I only post to periodically. And usually I spent a long time trying to figure out what I wanted to do with this channel. Mostly it's clips of other people's content that I sort of want to remember. I don't have the full treatment like the Broken Clock Tower Discord, all their reapers that the that army that Grim Grizz is assembling has on the internet, but Bethel McGrew sent me the This Present Darkness video from Andrew Klavan after the Gaza attack on the Jews. And his section on the Jews, I thought, was really excellent. And maybe I should play it, because I thought it was a tremendous piece.
Because of the specific nature of their relationship. The Jews are special and unique because of the specific nature of their relationship with God. And before those of you who don't believe in God turn me off or put your fingers in your ears and whistle Dixie or whatever it is you do to keep from hearing the truth, you do not have to believe in God to see that what I am saying is obviously and undeniably true. The Jews are a successful minority, and that makes people envious, but other minorities have been more successful at different times. The Jews are annoying, but that's the opposite of unique. Everybody is actually annoying in his own way. The only thing that's really different about the Jews is the specific nature of their relationship with God. And the reason I say you don't have to believe in God to understand this, you just have to understand that God is an inescapable entity in human psychology. No society has ever survived without God. No society until now has ever existed without God. Even atheists have to actively disbelieve in God, whereas children will come to God without anybody telling them about Him. God is a facet of the human mind. And you can believe He's a fantasy. You can say, well, that's a, you know, it's a fantastical fantasy, like a dragon or something. You can believe anything you want. I believe that Aaron Judge is a fantasy and I'm the real right fielder of the Yankees. Richard Levine believes his manhood is a fantasy and he's a woman. You can believe anything is a fantasy, but fantasy or not, God is an inescapable entity in man's psychology. And from the moment the Jews replaced human sacrifice with symbolic sacrifice, the Jews' relationship to God became unique. And the story of the Bible is God teaching them about, with a stick and a carrot, is teaching them about that uniqueness. You can't do what other men do. He keeps saying this to them. You can't sacrifice. All the people around you are sacrificing children and babies. You can't do it. That's for them. That's not for you. You can't worship rocks and trees and statues that you made. That's for others. You can't be slaves like other people are. You have to be free men. And all through this, all through the story of the Bible, read it for yourself, all through the history stories of the Bible, the Jews fight back. They say, please, please let us be slaves. In Egypt, they give us food. Please let us kill babies, everyone around us. Well, everybody around us is doing it. Why do we have to be different? Why do we, please let us put up statues and worship them. They keep doing it over and over until everyone doesn't hate us. Don't make us different. Let us have a king. All the kids have a king. Let us have a king too. This is where the word schmuck comes from, because God keeps saying, schmuck, I'm trying to make you my people. Stop complaining, because the first enemy of the Jews is the Jews, as God is forming them into what? They don't want to be different. Why should they? They don't want to be attacked on every side. They don't want to be hated. They don't want people saying, oh, they peel off to themselves. They think they're superior to everyone. You know, one of my brothers once joked that the reason the Jews are called the chosen people is because no one would volunteer. I think that's true. But over slow centuries, they are shaped into an entity that is different, that is special, because they are the theater. This is why they're special. And please hear this carefully. They're not special because they're better than other people. They're not special because they're better looking or smarter or anything like that. They're special because they are the theater in which God plays out His relationship with humankind. And again, you don't have to believe in God to understand that this is true. They are, I will explain how it's true, they are the theater in which God plays out His relationship with humankind.
And I thought that was an excellent way. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that the Jews have this rule about no mediums. And if you look at, you know, the Greeks, you've got their mediums, you've got the oracle at Delphi, oracles, prophets. Mediums, of course, try to contact the dead usually. I mean, a lot goes into this. And of course, the priests do connect with God, but of course, they're monotheistic, yada, yada, yada. But it's a strange rule, and it's a different rule. And as I was reading the book, I was thinking about too much interest in UFOs and that rule. Now, I've had a few people who have been messaging me incessantly, not incessantly, that's too much. I have a few people that have messaged me quite a bit about, you got to address this UFO thing. And it's like, do I really have to? No, I don't really have to. Do I want to? And of course, Cal sends me the book. And of course, if Cal sends me the book, it's got a lot of credibility because it's Cal. And then I read it and I think, oh, I do have to think about this. Because Cal was right in that many of the sort of epistemic practices, decisions within sort of sorting through this are important. Now, I've also had a fair number of Orthodox people that are just out there saying, yeah, UFOs are demons. Oh. And this is, of course, where the worldviews very much come into play. Because for materialists, UFOs are perhaps the products of other intelligences that have evolved underneath the uniform rules of physics and biology all over the universe, yada, 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 and certain number of them have passed certain thresholds and gotten here to Earth. I should probably find out what the name of that threshold is. Okay, this is the kind of thing that these AI bots are sort of helpful with now. If it got it factually wrong, which these AI bots often do, then you can correct me in the comment section. The Great Filter is a hypothetical barrier that prevents civilizations from advancing beyond a certain point. It is believed that the filter could be behind the lack of evidence in extraterrestrial life, as it could be that most civilizations never get past the filter. The idea was first proposed by economist Robin Hanson in an online essay called The Great Filter, Are We Almost Past It? In October 1996. The Great Filter is the idea that in the development of life from the earliest stage to the abiogenesis to reaching the highest levels of development in the Kardashian scale. I think that's different from the Kardashians. I don't think we're on their scale at all. There's a barrier to development that makes detectable extraterrestrial life exceedingly rare. Now, of course, that whole idea is founded within a certain worldview. And when some Orthodox people say angels or extraterrestrials are demons, well, there's another world. And if you're talking, let's say, Skinwalker Ranch, Native Americans would agree. And I'm not going to discount it because, again, there should be a bit of epistemic humility to say, well, what was that that cured Dulce's dog? What is an angel? But even the Bible says that demons can masquerade as angels of light. And what that means is that we don't know. And so for me, this prohibition in the Bible about mediumship should probably offer a little bit of wisdom that I don't think it's inappropriate to study these things, but one should be careful with it. And one should take a great deal of probably not get too carried away, because I think the force of the Jewish law that was held by Christians and has continued to be maintained against dabbling in the occult, doing a bunch of things like that, is you're dealing with powers that are far beyond yourself. You do not want to open doors that you cannot close. And you do not want to open doors that you don't know really what's on the other side of. And so, truth be told, live with what you have in front of you. Things may appear to you, things might intrude, but even in the case of James, now, what's interesting about Ray's story was that at one point he's heard from some people with all his research that you can summon these things. And of course, so then I'll go back to that story. The next event occurred in May of 2012, when Dulce reportedly saw a huge blimp-sized UFO outside her house with stained glass windows like that of a church all around the craft. When Dulce later visited Mexico, she claimed to have seen a series of additional UFO sightings, some of her family, and saw 3 8-foot-tall humans looking dressed in white monk's robes floating in front of her. Now, again, given Dulce, she probably said, we saw angels. Other people are going to say, you saw UFOs. And this interpretive guide, this how the worldview sort of impresses it upon the interpretation is extremely significant. Because the truth is, I mean, it's some people don't even know what a woman is. I couldn't resist. But even someone that you've known all of your life, they still, and I've spoken about this with respect to, again, my wife and I have been married 35 years. In some ways, we know each other better than ever, but you have this interesting dynamic with knowing that the more you know, the more you can see that you don't know. Ray had his own sightings. The next event provided Ray with more information about the phenomenon and further changed his life in its direction. It was also witnessed by his daughter, he said, and three of his friends. By this time, his wife had been having regular sightings of giant UFOs. For her, these were angels and evidence of sacred contact. She did not see Ray about these encounters at the time because she had become concerned about his increasing obsessive interest in UFOs and literature about them. On August 25, 2012, a few months after the appearance of the plasma energy being, a friend of the family came by for help with some traffic tickets. Ray decided to wait for him outside. It was around 9:30 p.m. The sky was dark and cloudy and completely devoid of stars. Ray had been learning about UFOs and knew that some people attempted to call them down. Ray thought, "I'm going to try this," so he did. And I think that sounds foolish. 15 minutes went by and there was no result. Ray thought to himself, "I'm freaking losing it. I'm going nuts," and he stopped. Just at that moment, he saw an enormous object over his neighbor's roof and backyard. Ray describes the object as huge, approximately 2 to 3 city blocks in length. It was hovering about 5 feet above his neighbor's house, and he saw hundreds of swirling white lights. And then the story goes on from there. And the people who came by were not interested in this thing. And you always see sort of these weird things that... And to me, this is completely consistent, sort of like the professor's observation about Lucy and time. Not everybody's going to see these things in the same light because, again, their worldviews have limits and act as filters. But at the same time, I read this stuff with a degree of caution and say, what perhaps ought not to dabble in these kinds of things too much or especially pursue you. Yeah, when they come to you, you have to think about how you want to think about them. Now, at this point, a whole bunch of ortho bros have been yelling at their smartphones and computers saying, "Seraphim Rose, Seraphim Rose." So, see, you've summoned Seraphim Rose to the video. Congratulations. Because Seraphim Rose actually talks about this. And again, in some ways, now it's interesting, you can find Matthew Pajot talking about these issues because Matthew Pajot's got ideas about how... I haven't recorded the tweets or anything, but I've been reading what Matthew's been writing on Twitter. And, you know, Jonathan Pajot has touched on it briefly. Well, Seraphim Rose is known in his book, Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future, to talk about these. And you don't have to just look for them in the book. Someone has nicely compiled what he's written into a few key passages. And I'll put the link in the comment description or in the notes down below. What then is the meaning of the UFO phenomenon of our time? Why have they appeared at just this time in history? I'm not sure that they're necessarily appearing more now. I personally believe the reason that we're probably going to see a shift in how they are regarded culturally is because of the recession of modernity. And culturally, we are changing. And so the materialist worldview sort of acted like a filter. And just like that woman's ghost filter, the UFOs sort of bounce off and lay in front of the filter and don't pass through to get into the interpretation of the worldview, into the worldview mechanics. And for Christians, that's been the same thing. Christians have basically had sort of a materialist filter. But materialism is going away. Modernity is going away. And so things are going to get strange. But this is Seraphim Rose's take, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in this take. First, UFO phenomena are but one part of an astonishing outpouring of paranormal events, and even that word is just so modernistic. Just a few years ago, most people would have considered as miracles. Dr. Vallée, he's talked about in the book, The Invisible College, expresses the secular appreciation of this fact. Observations of unusual events suddenly loom into our environment by the thousands, causing a great shifting of man's belief patterns and his entire relationship with the invisible. Now, he wrote this in 1975. is, well, it's about to be 50 years ago. So things don't change that fast. And it's not like we're inundated with it, but it just makes sense that for a whole bunch of reasons, for example, the Navy having better instruments, what has been sort of out there with respect to personal observation, now there's going to be more what we call evidence, but all of that isn't going to change everything. Every time you see something in the news, such as, you know, these little men that they're x-raying in Mexico, or story of the UFO that landed in the backyard in Nevada, and you can look those up. Those things happened within this year. Everyone's like, this will change everything. And the truth is, it changes nothing. Because people are not like that. Just like two people experience the same miracle. One person then becomes a Christian and the other person yawns and says, yeah, strange things happen. This is how we are. In Christian language, this means a new demonic outpouring is being loosened upon mankind. In the Christian apocalyptic view at the end of the book, we see that the power, which until now has been restrained in the final and most terrible manifestation of demonic activity on earth, has been taken away. Orthodox Christian government and public order, whose chief representative on earth was the Orthodox emperor, we haven't had one of those for a very long time. And the Orthodox Christian worldview no longer exists as a whole, and Satan has been loosed out of his prison. Second, UFOs are but the newest of mediumistic techniques by which the devil gains initiates into his occult realm. And I think that was sort of the point that I was making. They are a terrible sign that man has become susceptible to demonic influence as never before in the Christian era. I'm always suspicious of claims like never before. I was just listening to Trevor Wax has a podcast, and somebody said, never before has the church been in such bad shape. And I thought, really? Color me skeptical. The church is always in bad shape. And the church, I mean, it's so much of it just depends where you're looking and what you're measuring by. And now the conclusion here. We live near the end of this fearful age of demonic triumph and rejoicing, when the eerie humanoids, another of the masks of the demons, has become visible to thousands of people by their absurd encounters to take possession of the souls of these men whom God's grace has departed. Sounds like election. Is he a Calvinist? The UFO phenomena is a sign to Orthodox Christians to walk all the more cautiously and soberly on the path of salvation. That should be a perennial sign to always walk cautiously on the path of salvation, knowing that we can be tempted and seduced not merely by false religions, but even by seeming physical objects which just catch the eye. In earlier centuries, Christians were very cautious about strange and new phenomena, knowing the devil's wiles. But after the modern age of enlightenment, most people have become merely curious about such things and even pursue them, relegating the devil to a half-imaginary realm. Awareness of the nature of UFOs, then, can be a help in awakening Orthodox Christians to conscious spiritual life of a conscious Orthodox worldview that does not easily follow after these fashionable ideas of the time. Actually, the Modernist of Filter did a pretty good job of that, too. You know, in some ways, this is sort of analogous to and not disconnected from, you know, psychedelic exploration of drugs, in that it's funny that a lot of people out there are, you know, screaming against dualism and then not showing proper concern about spiritual forces and psychedelic drugs. Oh, it can't be spiritual. It's just a substance. Oh, well, that doesn't sound terribly Protestant of me, but there we have it. The conscious Orthodox Christian lives in a world that has clearly fallen, both the earth and the stars above, all being equally far from the lost paradise for which he is striving. So I'll put the link below this. I showed the cover of the book. Here's the thing, if you want to read Seraph and Rose on that. And again, I'm skeptical about his now more than ever type statements, because if you read almost any eschatological thing written in the church by Martin Luther or medievals or people during World War II that were quite convinced that Adolf Hitler was the Antichrist and the apocalypse was near, and especially given nuclear weapons and everything. Now more than ever, it's easier to make that argument with respect to, let's say, nuclear weapons, but I don't know. And so having a posture of epistemic humility, I think, is really helpful. And now more than ever, we should probably be careful out there. So I'm sure I'll make more videos about this. Maybe Rod and Kale would like to have a conversation about this. I would certainly be open to that. And, you know, you can read, let's say, well, Paul Kingsnorth has been writing about Wells and writes about the head of St. Edmund. St. Edmund, who didn't do so well in his battle against the Danes. Then I watched this series on Netflix. Well, that could be an avenue into something, of course. Didn't do so well, and his body was filled with arrows, and his head was cut off. And the cool thing about Europe is that you can find these monuments and stuff. But then some of his people decided they wanted to go out and find Edmund. And the next part of the story is the best. After the heathen army had departed, Edmund's people went looking in the forest for the king's head. They searched. They heard a voice calling, "Hic, hic, hic," Latin for "here, here, here." And they found his head between the paws of a great gray wolf who had been guarding it from its enemies. Naturally, a holy well then sprung up at the site. Edmund's head and body became the center of one of the greatest shrines and one of the best-known pilgrimages in medieval Europe, at the abbey in the town named after him, Bury St. Edmund's. The shrine was destroyed in 1539 by a new breed of Christian during the great orgy of vandalism that's sometimes known as the stripping of the altars under Henry VIII. The gold and the silver were ripped from the shrine and sent to the royal treasury. The abbey was dissolved and its monks were forcibly dispersed. I had always thought that that was, like so many relics during the Reformation, those of St. Edmund's had been lost. And then he goes through the story, and it's all very interesting. And of course, I, being a Protestant, have a degree of skepticism about all these things. And again, I don't know that skepticism is necessarily a bad thing. But again, one should have some epistemic humility. How do I know if, you know, God sent a great gray wolf to make sure that through Edmund he was producing faith in England for a number of centuries? And of course, as with the bronze serpent on a pole, works of God at one point can be a snare to people at another point. And that is almost always true. So, yeah, things are weird out there. I hope Rod Dreher finds a publisher for his book, because I'll be looking forward to reading all of the stories that he has in it, because I'm still the little boy that's interested in Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of, but now as an older Christian, have still a cautious but a humble approach to it, because who knows what God is doing and will do. So there's the first UFO video. Sorry to disappoint. Leave a comment. Tell me what I got wrong.